with the state budget. It was a very long week. The legislators and governor passed and signed a $142 billion spending plan for the state fiscal year, which began April 1st. It was a little bit late, just by a few hours. But many of the controversial policy reforms pushed by Governor Cuomo did not make it into the final budget. This new budget covered some policy changes in two areas the governor was pushing that I want to mention. One was ethics reform, and the other is education. Many of the items the governor wanted to see addressed in this budget fell off the table during negotiations, but they may be taken up later in the session. Those included higher minimum wage, criminal justice reforms, including raising the age of when teens can be prosecuted as adults to 18, property tax relief, and an education tax credit, which, in my opinion, is just a tax giveaway to wealthy individuals and corporations to fund private and charter schools. And the DREAM Act also fell out of the budget negotiations. The DREAM Act allows undocumented students to apply for tuition assistance when they go to college. As I said, some or all of these issues may be taken up later in the remainder of the legislative session, which goes until mid-June. So we shall see if any work gets done on them. One issue that did make it into the budget, a tax break for people purchasing yachts and private planes to help the super rich keep their vehicles in New York State waters and in New York State skies. The justification, according to Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos, it creates jobs. One of the issue areas we've talked a lot about on this show is ethics reform. Governor Cuomo touted the new ethics deal in the budget as, and I quote, "the nation's strongest and most comprehensive rules for disclosure of outside income by public officials, reforming the long-abused per diem system, revoking public pensions for those who abuse the public's trust, defining and eliminating personal use of campaign funds, and increasing transparency of independent expenditures." Well, what do good government groups think of the governor and legislators' groundbreaking ethics reform proposals? In one word, inadequate. I'm going to quote from a press statement that NYPERG, Common Cause, the Brennan Center for Justice, Citizens Union, and Reinvent Albany put together after seeing the ethics reforms that the legislature and governor passed. They state, "New York needs a much stronger response than the ethics voted on by the governor and the legislature to solve Albany's crime wave of political corruption. That even the incremental reforms included in this budget were difficult to achieve indicates the powers that be in Albany are not fully responsive to the public's demand for transformative change in our state capital. The new ethics agreement does not limit the amount of outside income an elected official can earn. It will, however, add needed information to what is publicly disclosed about lawmakers' outside income. In many cases, lawmakers will now have to disclose the names of their clients. However, there are many exemptions that can be granted. The ethical problems that have plagued Albany too often include controversies surrounding lawmakers' use of their public office for private gain and pay-to-play schemes at the highest levels of government. Relying on outer disclosure requirements alone to address such potential conflicts does not fix that problem. Moreover, it remains to be seen whether New York's ethics agreements actually closes a large loophole in outside income disclosure by which lawyer legislators who are of counsel to law firms with clients who do big business with the state are able to shield their source of income from public disclosure. We urge New York's elected officials to see the steps taken today as reactive and initial steps in the long march to truly reforming the way that business is done in Albany. Meaningful reform must include a limit on legislators' outside income, as well as comprehensive campaign financing changes, such as public financing of election campaigns, and fully closing the campaign finance LLC loophole. Much work remains." That statement came from five good government groups who have been pushing for years for Albany to clean up its act. I don't think we will see any further attempt by the legislature and governor to clean up Albany's pay-to-play culture during the rest of this session. But there is hope. We're following a bill sponsored by Senator Daniel Squadron that closes the LLC loophole, which allows essentially unlimited amounts of money to be funneled through corporations set up for individuals, and something that is at the heart of the corruption charges filed against former Speaker of the Assembly Sheldon Silver. Senator Squadron's bill, which is numbered S-60, is being forced on the Elections Committee agenda. So we will see how the election members vote for it when that happens. Thankfully, we can count on U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara for more than anyone else to keep the spotlight on cleaning up Albany. Another contentious area during budget negotiations was the debate over the governor's education reform proposals. In the end, the governor did not get everything he wanted in education and touted his changes and budget amount for education as the most pro-teacher budget ever. In his proposed budget, Governor Cuomo wanted to give greater weight to state tests and teacher evaluations and make it harder to get tenure and easier to fire teachers with tenure if they don't score well on these tests. Also, failing schools, those that have been underfunded for years, would be taken over by another entity. The governor also tied his proposed increase of $1.1 billion to education funding only if his proposals were adopted, and refused to provide schools with school aid runs. In the end, the governor got some of what he wanted. Teachers cannot receive tenure before 4 years in the classroom and must be rated effective or higher on evaluations. The debate over how the evaluation formula will rely on state tests has been punted to the State Education Department. Schools will see a historic increase of $1.4 billion, and $75 million will be provided to struggling schools who have 1 year to make progress before they are put into receivership. We will have an education expert on our show in a few weeks when the dust has settled to talk about these changes and how they're impacting schools in our area. Now let's get on to the rest of the show. We're going to take a little break, but it's been a long, cold winter, and everyone is ready for spring. Spring means rain. Whatever was spread on our roads to make them drivable this winter, sand, salt, and in some instances, fracking brine, will end up getting washed away by rainwater. Unfortunately, it also means it'll end up in our storm drains, our sewers, our streams, and our rivers. We're going to take a short break and listen to Creedence Clearwater Revival's Have You Ever Seen the Rain? And then we'll be introducing our guests. Taking callers for the second half of the Albany Report. If you want to ask a question on the air on today's topic, you can call 518-828-0290 or call in via Skype at WGXC-FM. And welcome back to the Albany Report. I'm here with my guests. and I'll be introducing. Thank you guys for coming in. First, we have Misty Duval. She's the staff attorney for Watershed Program for Riverkeeper, and Elizabeth Moran, Water and Natural Water and Natural Resources, but that is what it is. Your Water and Natural Resources Associate for Environmental Advocates of New York. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. Very excited to be here.
Excellent. So, Misty, why don't we start with you? Our topic is fracking waste, but could you first tell us about what you do for Riverkeeper and the types of information you guys track?
Sure. So Riverkeeper is a small nonprofit. We're a member-supported watchdog organization dedicated to supporting the Hudson River and its tributaries and protecting the drinking water of 9 million New York City and Hudson Valley residents. We've been part of the fight against fracking in New York for several years. More recently, the past few years, we've started working on this issue of fracking waste. And as we'll hear today, especially from Liz, there are a lot of different facets to this issue. A lot of different kinds of waste from a lot of different places, a lot of different places that it's going, and a lot of different municipalities and counties in the state trying to grapple with how to handle it. From Riverkeeper's perspective, we've really been focusing on two aspects of this issue. The first, which we'll talk, I think, a little bit in detail today, is this issue of road spreading. What happens in New York is that waste from oil and gas extraction and gas storage that's currently happening in New York. So we're talking about low volume conventional fracked wells using less water, less intensive than what you commonly hear is high volume fracking that happens in other states. That's currently going on in New York. And when you extract the oil and gas, you have something called production brine that comes up with it. It's a very salty substance that also unfortunately contains whatever contaminants are underground along with the oil and gas. Sometimes it can include some of the fluid that went down to try and push out the oil and gas for extraction that can have some chemicals in it. And in New York State, that production brine is allowed to be used on our roads for de-icing, dust suppression, road stabilization, things like that. And so we were getting, you know, a lot of questions about this issue. And so we decided to write to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation under the Freedom of Information Law and ask them for information about how this program works, where they had approved the use of this brine on our roads, because it's not information that's publicly available. You have to specifically ask for it. We got information through 2011 and from mid 2011 through early 2014. That information is summarized on our website. You can go to www.riverkeeper.org or Google Riverkeeper, the facts about New York and fracking waste. If you want to take a look at the information we received from DEC that we'll talk about in detail a little bit later on today.
Great. I mean, that was information you gathered through the Freedom of Information.
It is, yes.
Act, which we've talked about previously under Sunshine Week. And this is one of the reasons why it's so important to have access to public information. So we will definitely get more into that discussion with you, but I wanted to make sure we gave our other guest, Elizabeth Moran, a chance to introduce herself and talk about environmental advocates and the report that you wrote.
Thanks. I'm the Water and Natural Resources Associate with Environmental Advocates of New York. We are Albany's Green Watchdog Group. We monitor air. We make sure New York's environment has clean air, clean water, protecting our wildlife and our land. And we make sure that our folks in Albany are doing their job to protect the environment and they aren't passing bad bills. And we try to communicate this to regular New Yorkers. So Environmental Advocates has also been doing a lot of work on fracking for a long time now, and my report, which is called License to Dump, you can find it on our website at eany.org. We focus on fracking waste that's coming from Pennsylvania from their high-volume hydraulically fracked sites to landfills in New York State. We found out this has been going on since at least 2010. As Misty was starting to discuss, it involves a lot of different types of wastes. This includes everything from flowback fluid, which is the fluid that comes up after fracking, to what most people are aware about going to the landfills, drill cuttings, which is pieces of the shale that gets cut up during the drilling process. And we're very concerned about this. Once this waste goes to landfills, water contamination is something that becomes essentially inevitable. These wastes have what's known as radium-226 and radium-228. So there's radioactivity in these wastes, and radium is also highly water-soluble. So when it rains, there's leachate pools at landfills that collect the radium and any other contaminants are in the waste at the landfill. This leachate is then sent for treatment at wastewater treatment plants. And here's where the big problem is. There isn't a single wastewater treatment plant in New York State that's capable of treating radiation. So now these wastewater treatment plants can't treat the radiation, and the what's left gets discharged into water bodies that could serve as drinking water supplies for communities. You know, obviously, New York State, we're proud of our high-quality water, and to risk contamination like this is a serious detriment.
And that's why you wrote the report, License to Dump, despite New York having a ban on high-volume hydraulic fracturing. We are still accepting the waste product from this process that's occurring in other states like Pennsylvania. And it is coming here and getting into our communities and our landfills. So let's start with what's on the roads now, because I think people get confused, and kind of one of the reasons I wanted you both to come in when you say fracking waste and fracking brine and road spread and road usage, and there's two different processes that fracking waste is coming from. So Misty, let's go back to the road brine.
Sure.
So as you said, what's allowable in New York State today is you can use fracking waste, and is that what we're calling it, from low volume conventional fracking wells production that's going on in New York State today?
Correct. And you hear people refer to it by a lot of names. Fracking waste, oil and gas waste. But there is a very large train going by us right now. I'll try to speak over it. Specific kind of waste is called production brine. So a lot of people also call it production brine or produced fluid. It's less, you know, how people want to call it. We just need to be clear on what exactly it is. And as you mentioned, it is waste that's coming from oil and gas production that's currently happening in New York State. So it's not the high volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing that New York has banned. It's low volume conventional hydraulic fracturing that's been happening in the state for decades.
Can you just explain the difference between high volume and low volume?
Sure. There are a lot of differences. The main difference that you can kind of think of is in terms of volume and intensity. So low volume fracking, a lot of times it tends to be vertical, so it just goes straight down into the ground. It tends to use, you know, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of gallons of water, whereas high volume fracking tends to use in the millions of gallons of water. And oftentimes to go down into the shale for high volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing, it'll go down vertically and then it'll actually make a turn and continue horizontally.
It's also going deeper.
It is going deeper. And it's also often more intensive. You'll have a lot more wells in an area. You'll have a well pad that may have several different offshoots in an area. You'll have more truck traffic because it's taking in a higher volume of water, it's taking out a higher volume of waste, things like that.
And where is conventional fracking in the state going on now?
In the state now, it's mainly going on in areas in western New York.
So we're not seeing it around here in our communities, but is happening in some parts of the state.
Right. Mostly in the southern tier in western New York.
And the production brine from that process, does it also have chemicals? Are you utilizing chemicals? Because I know in the high volume hydraulic fracturing production, one of the concerns is the amount of chemicals, hazardous chemicals, that are used in that process.
Right.
Is the use of chemicals a problem with conventional fracking?
It can be. The type of waste that we see spread on the road, production brine, is a little bit different from the chemical mixture that Liz was talking about called fracking fluid that actually goes down into the well initially. Some of that fluid can stay down there, gets trapped down there, and will come up along with production later. But it's a little bit different in that the chemical mixture that goes down, most of it does tend to come straight back up. And then it'll be disposed of in ways that Liz is going to talk about a little bit later. And then once production actually starts, you get production brine that starts coming up. There's going to be a little bit of that fluid that gets trapped, but there's also going to be a lot of the contaminants that are trapped underground along with the oil and gas itself. So people think of these as naturally occurring, so they're okay, but
yeah,
you have them.
It sounds nice, naturally occurring.
Yeah, right? It sounds nice. It sounds great. You know, arsenic's naturally occurring, but you would spread it on your breakfast cereal, right?
Right.
So the concern is that, you know, when you have this oil and gas coming up, you have this production brine coming with it, there are things like BTEX chemicals, you know, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, that are down in the shale, and also non-shale formations, sandstone formations, other kind of formations where you get oil and gas in New York. They can also have radioactivity. There's more radioactivity in shale formations, but it does also exist in the other formations as well. You also have very high levels of chloride, which is, you know, basically salt, why you want to use it, right? Brine is salty water.
Hence the de-ice. Well, that's why
yes.
we want to use it on the roads.
That's exactly right. Hence the de-icing. But the concern that we see with this production brine is that it has such high levels of chloride, it's so concentrated, that you end up putting a higher level of chloride on the road than you need. And that's a concern because it also runs off the road. You can end up getting chloride buildup in aquatic systems, in drinking water if it runs into a drinking water supply. It could also damage infrastructure if it runs into wastewater treatment facilities, gets on your car. So that's something we want to be concerned about as well.
So the wastewater treatment facilities we have here in New York State are biological mm-hmm. in nature. So when you add higher concentrations of salt, that can affect the makeup of those wastewater treatment facilities and make it more difficult for them to process
right.
Whatever's coming through their system.
Right.
So that's why you're concerned about the chloride amount.
That's one concern about the chloride, but a really big concern about the chloride concentration running off roadways is if it just runs off the roadway and it gets into a stream nearby the road, or if it gets into a stream that feeds into an underground aquifer, it can contaminate drinking water supplies, it can contaminate the stream, it can kill aquatic life, it can kill plants in the stream, and it's something that tends to build up over time, and we already see it in the Northeast. It's already a problem because, you know, we have no choice but to use salt on our roads, right?
Right.
If we want to walk outside in the winter, we have to use salt on our roads. So we need to be thinking about ways to lessen the impacts instead of increasing the impacts. And again, it's not just the chloride. The chloride is a big problem, and I don't want people to overlook it. But with this kind of production, Brian, mm-hmm. you also have, you know, you can also have these other kind of presence, you know, these chemicals and naturally occurring materials that are stuck underground and come up along with the brine that get on our roadways as well.
Well, one of the questions we got before the show aired through our email was, what is DEC's role in approving whether or not you can put this brine on the roads? What does a municipality, you know, have to go through? Because isn't someone checking to make sure that we're not harming our streams with this product?
So in order to get permission to use fracking waste on the roadways, you have to go through an approval process with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and you have to apply for something that's called a beneficial use determination, or a BUD, just so I don't have to say beneficial use determination over
okay.
and over again.
BUD.
Yes, a BUD.
And we're not talking about beer.
We are not talking about beer, unfortunately. We're talking about a much more boring process. So what happens is that, you know, a municipality or a private entity that wants to spread this on the roads, they'll petition the Department of Environmental Conservation for a BUD. There are regulations governing the BUD program, And they're supposed to give information, including how they'll make sure that this waste doesn't contaminate, for example, water bodies nearby, contaminate the roadside. They have to say how many times they'll apply it. They have to provide information, testing information.
On what's actually in it?
Well, in theory, they are actually supposed to provide testing information about what's actually in it. But the way that the Department of Environmental Conservation administers this program, they have certain parameters that they require testing for, but they don't require representative testing of the actual brine that goes on the they don't require testing of the actual brine that goes on the road.
What are they testing?
Well, all they require is a representative sample from the well field. And so you can have dozens of wells in a field. As we know, contaminants can vary quite a bit from well to well. What actually goes on the road can vary quite a bit depending on concentration and if it's mixed with it, you know, different wells. So by just taking what they call a representative sample from the well field, we don't know exactly what's in the brine that's going on the road.
Neither does DEC.
Neither does DEC. That's right. Another concern with this BUD program is that DEC doesn't require follow-up testing. We've seen a couple of reports in the information that we got from the Department of Transportation where they use this information. They submit annual reports. We haven't seen them from anyone else. We haven't seen DEC require them. DEC has a notice that sets out the guidelines for this program. It's not required in there. And they also don't require testing for radioactivity.
So that's an issue, even though it's a conventional well.
Right.
We're concerned about radioactivity.
We are. It's something that can be present in conventional wells as well, and something that we definitely want to test for. Because, again, even if it is at a lower level, it's something that's going on the roads. And I've seen a BUDS approved for as high as 30 applications per road segment per season. So you're taking whatever amount is in there and you're reapplying it 30 times on the same amount of road over the season. And that's just what they're approved for. I mean, another concern with the way this program is administered is that there's no follow-up inspection. There's no enforcement. So somebody gets a BUD and there's no knowing how, if they actually comply with what they say they're going to do, if they actually apply it 30 times or if they apply it 60 times, there's no one out there looking.
And there's, and I guess the real test is what's the impact on the water environment near the roads or where it's being applied? Is there any, how do you test that?
Well, I mean, that's something that I think is becoming a question and a concern for more and more municipalities. Because, you know, you have a lot of different things in the environment, and the role of the municipalities and the role of DEC is to show us that what is being put on our roads is safe before it's put on our roads.
Right.
It's not to go out and
that sounds like the role
try
of
and
government
figure out what's happening
too.
Afterward. It is the role of government, yes.
So, Liz, do you... I mean, you've been following the conversation here, and Environmental Advocates has been very active in Albany. I mean, is your organization looking at these regs and these types of rules or laws that govern the conventional spreading of fracking waste?
You'll find a lot of a lot of what Misty was talking about, you'll see going on with the high volume waste that I discuss in my report as well. You see a lot of the same problems where there's a general lack of oversight. There's a total lack of testing, and regulations are weak. There's really not too much that is on the books to regulate fracking waste. So, yeah, we're absolutely watching, dogging this. You know, there's a lot that can be done by the executive. There's a lot that can be done by DC, and there's a lot that the legislature could take on as well.
Are there any shining lights out there on the conventional? I mean, I'm glad that you as, you know, I think one of the roles of not-for-profits and for people to get involved in not-for-profits who are advocacy or organizations like yours is you're taking a look at the process, what's occurring, what's going on, and hopefully coming up with a light that helps us shine, here's a problem, and then how do we fix it? Are there any shining lights in Albany around, you know, the fracking brine issue that we should be paying attention to? Is there any legislation, for example, that's addressing this? Have you guys brought this up at at hearings, or is this an issue that's done on a local level, or do we have to look at it at the state level?
You know, one of the things that I've been really excited about working on this issue is the reaction that counties across New York State have had, and municipalities as well. For Riverkeeper, we've been focusing on helping several municipalities in the Hudson Valley and throughout the state to pass bans on the use of fracking waste on their roadways, and also a lot of counties have passed similar bans on accepting this waste into their landfills and wastewater treatment facilities. So throughout New York, so far, there are at least 15 counties that have passed different variations of these kinds of bans. You can find a list of those counties on our website at www.riverkeeper.org. Riverkeeper also has a model local waste ban that can be adapted for counties and municipalities on our website as well. You can also find not only a list of the counties, but links to the bans that have been passed. It's also something that has been taken up at the state level as well. There have been several different bans that would address different aspects of the waste, including one that you had last year that would address high vol waste coming from Pennsylvania that I believe Senator Hoylman has taken up this session.
Yes.
But for the road spreading, there are a few bills out there that would address it. Senator Hoylman, Assemblyman Appananti have a bill that's modeled on these county bans that focuses on road spreading in particular.
So is it your the position of the Riverkeeper that this shouldn't be allowed to be spread on our roads because we don't know what's in it and we don't have enough information about the impact on our water? Is that a fair assessment of your position?
That's exactly our position. We feel like it's something that poses a big risk to our water that's going to be longstanding. And there are a lot of other ways to de-ice a road. And given the gaps in DEC oversight, in the DEC regulations, the lack of enforcement, and the different kinds of contaminants, you know, radioactivity, benzene, toluene, high chloride levels that can be in this waste, we just don't think it's worth it.
Even in the conventional. So one of the questions we got was, how do you help a municipality if they figure out the municipality doesn't have a ban on this or their county doesn't have a ban? How can Riverkeeper help a municipality put a ban in place? What are some of the things that you guys do?
Sure. So the first thing is, again, to take a look at our model legislation. It can be adapted at the county or the municipal level. It's on our website at www.riverkeeper.org. We're also available to kind of provide information. Anyone can send us an email at info@riverkeeper.org to ask a question.
That's info@riverkeeper.org.
Yes, info@riverkeeper.org. A lot of times what happens is we'll see some local citizens or local community groups who will get involved in this issue at their county, their municipality. They'll take a look at our model law, or they'll take a look at their neighboring county's law or something like that. And they'll contact, you know, me with questions, and we're always happy to answer questions as we can. We're happy to support as we can. We've gone and testified in front of town boards, in front of county legislatures, about these bans and supporting these bans at the local level.
And when you see the bans that are being passed locally, are they for all fracking waste products?
Yes.
They are covering both conventional and high volume fracking?
Yes. Almost all of them include both conventional and high volume fracking. And our model legislation is actually written broadly to cover both. Because it's something that, you know, if you're going to address it all in one bill, you want to have everything there together. Plus, we know what's happening right now, but we don't know what's going to happen in the future. So it's better to tackle it all together right now.
And another question we got, is it legal to have high volume fracking waste used as road spread in New York State today?
New York State does not allow the use of high volume waste on the road. You know, there are there are often questions about what ends up happening in practice. But DEC has said publicly that they don't allow the use of high volume waste on the road. And the approvals that, you know, we have, again, from mid-2011 through early 2014, none of them show the use of high-volume waste on the road.
Because to get that DEC approval, you have to say where it's coming from.
Well,
and the process that is that you're using to get it out of the ground.
Yes, I'm going to caveat that a little bit, because that's actually an interesting question. So I'll say again that I haven't seen, you know, the high volume approval, and I'll take DEC at their word that they're not allowing it. But when we requested information from DEC, we received 35 BUD approvals. Only 25 of those specified where the brine was from. 10 of those didn't specify. So that's something, that's another thing that's concerning.
So there are 10 DEC approved plans that do not specify where the brine is coming from.
Right.
Why would that get approval?
That is an excellent question for the agency. And that's something, again, that we were very concerned about. It shows the disconnect between what's supposed to happen and what happens in reality.
Very, very interesting. Wow. So, Liz, fracking waste that we're talking about on the state level that's coming from high-volume fracking, it can't be spread on our roads, right? So we're totally fine with conventional fracking brine being spread on the road, right? You're okay with that from environmental advocates' point of view?
No, we're definitely not okay with that. You know, as Misty was saying earlier, it's really the volume that's the only difference here between low volume and high volume waste. They contain a lot of the same chemical constituents. There's a risk of radioactivity being these wastes. It's not safe to just be allowing this spread in our roads and disposed of in our wastewater treatment plants.
Why is it being allowed, I guess? I mean, from your perspective, I mean, and I agree with you guys. We don't know enough about what's occurring, what's in the waste. Why are we using it then?
I mean, I think it's a way to dispose of it. A lot of the approvals that we've seen are in municipalities that are near where the drilling's taking place. So I think it's, you know, it's fairly
easy. Is it cheaper than buying just plain old road salt?
Yes, it is cheaper for the municipalities. In some cases, we've seen municipalities actually get it for free. So there is definitely a financial incentive for the municipalities to use it.
How does a municipality have to disclose that they're using it? That, I mean, do they have to tell the public, oh, by the way, that road spray is, you know, has fracking? There's no, like, public disclosure that has to occur.
You know, I think that would depend on the individual municipality rules and regulations, but there's no statewide required disclosure. And I've definitely seen a lot of municipalities where they have been approved for this kind of waste and people didn't know about it.
Yeah, I would think that I would want to know.
I mean, I would want to know as well, right?
Is using it. So people can go to your website, riverkeeper.org,
right,
and find out if their municipality has been approved for it. That doesn't mean it's happening.
Right.
But check your local municipality if you have concerns about whether or not it's happening.
Right.
And then if you want to get some help from Riverkeeper about working on asking your municipality to put a ban in place, you can get that information and you can Google questions. You can send questions to info@riverkeeper.org.
That's right. And it's also important for this waste to recognize that the State Department of Transportation also uses it in some areas. Regions 4, 5, and 6 have approved to use it.
Now, where is Region 4, 5, and 6?
Those are also in Western New York.
Okay.
Again, very close to where this production is happening. So it's something that you also want to check about on your state highways, not only with your municipality, but your regional Department of Transportation.
So if I wanted to check my regional Department of Transportation, how do I do that? I mean, for Columbia and Greene County, where we're airing today, how would you go about doing that?
It's actually easier than it seems. You can go on the Department of Transportation's website, and you can just Google New York Department of Transportation.
So who decides what's spread on that portion of the thruway that goes through these counties?
Well, a lot of times it just depends on whether it's a state road or it's a municipal okay. road, whether the states retain control or the municipality or the county have been delegated, maintenance authority.
So it depends on the road.
It does depend on the road.
Okay.
It can be an incredibly complex issue. I mean, I've seen BUDs where, you might have a 10-mile road and only 5 miles of the road are approved for road spreading because they only need it on that 5 miles, so there's some other portion that goes into another town, and that town doesn't want to use it.
So Ulster County
can be very patchwork.
Ulster County put in place a ban
yes.
on all forms of fracking waste and said no spreading on our roads.
Right.
So that ban only covered the county-owned roads.
It depends. So there are bans that are worded in different ways, and I don't recall the wording of the Ulster ban off the top of my head. But again, it's on our website
okay.
if people want to check. But some counties have worded their bans, for example, Westchester County, to cover all roads in the county. And they think they have the authority to do that even on the state roads because they're protecting the public health and welfare of their citizens. Some counties have not taken that approach. And, for example, Putnam County has decided to limit their ban to county roads. So that would only apply in county roads. And in that county, you had the municipalities who actually followed up one by one
okay.
to pass the ban for municipal roads.
So it really depends on what's going on locally.
It does.
And who's taking a lead. And
it does. A lot of it comes down to local politics and what the localities are comfortable doing, which we feel like is fine. You have to figure out how things work in your area and do the best that you can there.
Yes, and this show is about learning what's going on in Albany, and sometimes Albany doesn't work. And you mentioned a bill that I introduced when I was a senator, mm-hmm. and it was, we don't allow high-volume hydraulic fracturing in the state to occur. We shouldn't allow the importation of fracking waste to come into New York State and be dumped potentially in our landfills.
Right.
And that was a legislation that I did sponsor, and I forced the Environmental Conservation Committee to take it up. And they did, and they voted it down 6-7. The Democrats voted for it. The Republicans voted against it. And the chair of the committee, Senator Grisanti, at the time actually said, I don't think this is actually happening. He didn't believe that fracking waste was coming into New York. And I'm happy to say that I noticed you included that quote in your report, license to dump, despite the ban, New York permits Pennsylvania to dump radioactive fracking waste inside our borders. So, Liz Moran, thank you for writing such an awesome report. Problem that showed is that if you don't agree there's a problem, you can't possibly agree on how to fix it. So we had legislators, chair of the Environmental Conservation Committee, saying it's not happening. We don't have to worry about it. And the report helps to show, okay, it is happening. And can you talk a little bit about your report and what you found?
Sure. So where we started was actually in Pennsylvania. So like Misty was saying earlier, there's really a lack of reporting that's going on with this issue. There's stuff that's not readily available to the public. So Pennsylvania, however, has a website. It's paoilandgas.com. Something, I apologize, I don't remember the whole link, but they do have data collection that occurs, and they show where that waste is coming from, what type of waste it is, how much of that waste, and where it's going.
So Pennsylvania has a website. This is public information, and the well drillers have to disclose where they're sending their fracking waste. They're using millions of gallons of water, and some of that does come back up, and they do have to dispose of the drill cuttings and material. And they actually say on Pennsylvania's state-funded website what they're doing with that fracking waste, and some of it is going to landfills here in New York. I was stunned when I learned that. I'm like, it is happening, people, and we're letting it. And so we should know what's going on. So what is going on with that waste?
So there's really large volumes of this waste that's coming to New York State. So it was recently updated, and we found out that at least since 2010, New York State landfills have accepted at least 510,000 tons of fracking waste and at least 23,000 gallons of fracking waste.
And where's it going?
It's going to, so there's five landfills that have accepted at various points in time. There's Chemung County Landfill. There's Highland Landfill, Allied Landfill, Hake C&D Landfill, and Seneca Meadows.
So
and
again, these, out in the western portion of the state.
Right. They're mostly in western New York and the southern tier. I think Seneca Meadows is more central New York, though. And they've gotten it all. They've got everything from drill cuttings and fracking fluids.
So what is the DEC's role on monitoring this type of waste that's coming into New York City? Because obviously they have to have a role in this.
Right. So DEC's role here is really to make sure, ideally, that toxic stuff isn't getting to the landfills. However, there's little in place to make sure that toxic stuff isn't getting in. So let me backtrack and sort of begin with how this started. In 2010, Chemung County Landfill was looking to expand its landfill, and residents were concerned because they knew that they were looking to accept fracking waste. And by the expansion, they were concerned that more would begin to be accepted there. So this was challenged by the residents, and because of this challenge, while DC said this is not going to be a part of the environmental impact statement process, this isn't going to affect their application to expand the size of the landfill, but we are going to take a look at this. So what came out of that was they determined that landfills accepting this should be installing radiation monitors. They need to test leachate at least two times a year. And most importantly, which we found out is not being closely watched, they only should be accepting drill cuttings and drilling mud. However, there's a lot of holes in this process. Namely, things aren't being watched closely enough. There's a lot of ways for different types of waste to slip through the cracks, and there's opportunities for radioactive waste, especially, to be slipping in. We have a letter from DC that went to Chemung that shows that their radiation monitors weren't being properly tested.
So this is really kind of a self-regulated industry where the people who are sending the waste and the people who are accepting it are making, are the ones that are enforcing whatever regulations there are?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, let's take a break. We have a caller on the line. Mary, are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Hi, Mary. Mary's from Cairo, and you wanted to say something to our guests?
Well, there's a couple of things. One thing, there's been a couple of points that you've said about, the vertical drilling in Chautauqua County in western New York. There's about one vertical well for every square mile, it's my understanding. A lot of it is also going on in Cayuga County. I know there's a lot going on in the southern tier, which you reported, but there's a lot of the vertical drilling. I just shared on the Albany Report page, Karen Edelstein has a fact tracker map, and I shared it on that page so people can go see it, which is actually showing where all the waste is coming from the southern, from Pennsylvania and going into New York State. There's one thing I just found out about. There's a company in Ravenna, so this is more applicable toward the Albany Report, called Shep Materials, and it has drying agents for stabilizing shale drill cuttings. There's not a whole lot of information on there about exactly who is buying it, but it looks like companies in Pennsylvania are buying it, and it supposedly makes the drill cuttings more acceptable to waste dumps, so it's probably ones that are really wet drill cuttings, and maybe, so it's something to look up. It's Shepherd Materials, and it's shepmaterials.com.
Okay, Mary, thanks. Let's let our guests respond to that. So there's a company, Mary mentioned, in Ravenna that is creating a material that drilling companies can then use to take the fluid. It gets mixed with the material, and then it becomes less fluid. It's more solid-like, right? So this an issue where what do we call what's coming out of the well? Is it liquid or is it solid? How does that impact what we do with it? And is that something we are concerned about?
So that's a really interesting point, actually. So Pennsylvania's page indicates the waste in gallons and tons, tons being drill cuttings and drilling mud and sand, and the fluids being flowback fluid, produced fluid, the brine. What's interesting is this waste has to be bulked up, and that's all of it. We're talking drill cuttings do. Drill cuttings don't come up like these dry pieces of shale. They actually come up with a lot of fluids that are already underground. So they have to be bulked up, and that's usually done with wood chips or a variety of other bulking agents. So it has to be solidified before it could be sent to landfills for acceptance. And what's also interesting about this is in permits for New York State landfills, wastes only have to be 20% solid to be accepted at that landfill. So that means up to 80% of what's contained and what's dumped there could be fluids. And in this case, it could be contaminated fluids.
And what do we call it when they accept it? Is it industrial waste? Is it hazardous waste? I mean, what does DEC call?
Construction debris.
No way.
Yes, that's absolutely what they call it. They've been referring to it as construction debris. It's from what they call the construction of the well. So it's not industrial, it's not hazardous, and those are actually huge loopholes, the fact that this waste is exempted from being considered hazardous in state law.
All right. I hadn't realized that they were calling it construction debris. So a well, let me just make sure I understand what you're saying. A high-volume horizontal fracking well in Pennsylvania can take what's coming up out of the well, because there is some that comes back up and includes drill cuttings, and may contain radioactive elements. And it's liquid, so they can take material, add to it like sawdust or whatever the material that this woman described was being provided by a company here in Ravenna. It gets bulked up, so it gets more solidified, and they can send it to a landfill in New York State, and it arrives, and it's called construction debris?
Yeah. That's what DEC is classifying as. They're calling it construction debris. And if it's bulked up, and like I said before, if these radiation monitors aren't working, there's the potential that some highly radioactive stuff is getting in these landfills.
So let's talk about the radiation monitors. So DEC is saying this is coming. You have to have a radiation monitor at the land site to a Geiger counter, right, that would alert the landfill that there's too much radioactivity coming off of this truck, right?
Right.
Is that what's going on?
Yeah. So let me also be clear. Not every landfill has Geiger counters or radiation monitors at the landfill. This was required after the landfills had been accepting this waste for a couple of years already. So the five landfills that have been accepting do have these installed, but not every landfill in New York State has radiation monitors. So theoretically, what will happen is if a load of waste is too radioactive, it'll set off the alarm and it'll be investigated. And if it falls within a certain spectrum, I believe as long as it's less than 50 picocuries per gram or liter, it can be, it would be determined if it's rejected or not. If it's over 50 picocuries per liter, theoretically, it should be rejected.
And why is that level the threshold? And is that an acceptable threshold? And feel free to jump in, Misty. Why are we worried about that? What happens once it gets into the landfill? It's a solid. It's, you know, construction debris. Why are we worried about this?
So, you know, when I talk about 50 picocuries, let me put it in perspective. So what the EPA has determined the maximum contaminant level, this is what is determined to be the highest level for things to still be safe. That's five picocuries per liter in water to be safe for drinking water supplies. So 50 picocuries per liter is still pretty high to be going to landfills. when it goes to the landfills, like I mentioned earlier, it runs off, it gets absorbed in the leachate pools, and that's sent to wastewater treatment facilities. I also mentioned there's testing of leachate that has to occur at these landfills. It gets a little wonky. For some reason, not all the landfills have been doing testing, but Chemung has, Highland has, and Hakes has, and these landfills have all seen increasing levels of radioactivity in their leachate.
And Misty, why are we worried about that, leachate having higher radioactivity levels than the EPA is recommending is safe?
Right. Well, I think we're worried about it because, as Liz mentioned, that leachate can go to, often goes to wastewater treatment facilities that aren't equipped to get rid of the radiation that's in it. And you may be looking at it and thinking, okay, well, 5 picocuries per liter is okay for our drinking water, so 50, that's only 10 times. That's fine. It'll get diluted. But it's not just, so assume it is 50 picocuries per liter and it goes into a landfill. It's not just one time that that landfill is going to be sending leachate to a wastewater treatment facility. It's not just one time that that landfill is going to be accepting this kind of waste. So they're going to be accepting this waste multiple times over years for many of the landfills. And so you'll see the contaminants in that waste build up. Mm. You'll see it become more concentrated in the leachate. And then over time, as it continues to go to the same wastewater treatment facilities, if those wastewater treatment facilities are unable to handle it, you can see it build up actually downstream from where those facilities discharge. And there's actually a little bit of information about this on our website at www.riverkeeper.org about some studies that were done in Pennsylvania where this happened.
All right, we are running out of time. So in the last couple minutes, what are you guys doing about it, or what are your recommendations? I know you had a number of recommendations in the report, Liz, that you wanted to see happen to help make sure that our landfills and whatever they're accepting makes sense and our communities and our water supply are safe.
Right. So we really think immediate action needs to be taken on this issue. And there's absolutely immediate action that the governor and DEC can take by issuing an emergency rulemaking and at least temporarily prohibiting the acceptance of fracking waste until rules are developed that would better regulate this. For us, that really should include a closure of the hazardous waste loophole, which, as I mentioned before, is a loophole in state law that allows fracking waste to not be considered hazardous waste. So they miss all of these increased regulations.
Well, I think that's a really key point, and unfortunately, we have to leave it there. So I'm going to say let's have you back and we'll talk more at a future date about the hazardous waste loophole, because I think that would solve a lot of issues around New York State when we're dealing with fracking waste, especially fracking waste that's coming from outside of New York. So I want to thank my guest, Misty Duval from Riverkeeper, and you can get more information at riverkeeper.org. And Elizabeth Moran, the author of License to Dump, and you can get more information about the report and actually read the report at environmentaladvocates.org. Did I get that right?
It's EANY.org.
EANY.org. Thank you both, and it was a fascinating discussion, and I'm sorry we've run out of time because I think there's more we can talk about. So until next time, we're sending you back to WGXC Studios for our regular programming, and this has been the Albany Report. Thank you for listening.